Hey, well, what's going on, people? It's Nate here. Thanks for tuning in to the Vinyl Guide Podcast. We've got an awesome one today. Two guests and an exclusive new track from Brown Acid Trip Number 12. You know, Brown Acid, the amazing compilation series featuring lost and nearly forgotten tracks from the early to mid-70s. This is a time where any band who wanted to leave their city or town needed to press a record, and all their hopes and dreams were wrapped up in each of those 200 or 300 records that they had pressed. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, many of those songs, those amazing psych jams, those prototypes for the heavy rock onslaught that was yet to come, well, some of those songs just didn't reach the right ears at the time. Well, at least until now, and those discerning ears are on each side of the head of Lance Baresi, the owner of Permanent Records and head curator for the Brown Acid series. Now, Lance is on today's show, along with Daniel Hall, the head honcho over at Riding Easy Records. Together, they are the dynamic duo that makes the Brown Acid series come alive. Now, each of them listen to hundreds, even thousands of these long-forgotten records. They pick only a handful of the top quality tracks, they do the research, they find the band members, they secure the rights, they clean up the audio, they compile, press the vinyl, and then they bring it to us. Now today we're going to talk to Lance and Daniel all about the Brown Acid series, their process, some fascinating insider stories, and of course, host the world premiere for a new track from the upcoming Brown Acid Trip Number 12. Which I must share, the vinyl pre-sale date for Trip Number 12 is Wednesday, February 17th. And there are always limited edition special pressings at RidingEasyRex.com. Special one-offs, cool splatters, melts, swirl pressings, all very special and only for the people who get in first. So there it is, Wednesday, February 17th. Write that date in your calendar, set yourself a phone reminder, whatever you got to do, and don't forget to take the Brown Acid Trip Number 12. Pre-orders start Wednesday, February 17th at RidingEasyRex.com. And by the way, there is more of this interview available to our Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/vinylguide. If you're part of our Patreon community, head up there now, enjoy a bit more of our conversation featuring a special announcement from our guests. Now, if you're curious, you're not part of our Patreon community, join us now, patreon.com/vinylguide. A few bucks a month helps keep this show going. It gets you access to extended interviews, secret episodes, ad-free interviews, and heaps more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us there and hear the rest of the show. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Lance and Daniel all about the Brown Acid series. Trip Number 12 vinyl pre-orders start Wednesday, February 17th. And stay tuned at the end for a sneak peek, an exclusive track from Brown Acid Trip Number 12. All right, this week on the Vinyl Guide, we are very fortunate. We are having a threesome. Unfortunately, it's two dudes and me. So, we have with us Lance Baresi and Daniel Hall. Now, Lance, who you may know, he owns Permanent Records, one of my favorite record shops in the world. And Daniel runs Riding Easy, which is a label that I trust 10,000%. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Fantastic. Thanks for having us on, Nate.
Hey.
Doing great. Thank you for the kind words, Nate.
No worries. Hey, happy to have you guys on because I know you guys have been working on the Brown Acid series for years. And I remember getting a copy of the first trip several years ago on one of my trips to LA. And I had no idea that a few years later we'd be talking about the 12th edition. Are you surprised it's gone this far?
Daniel? You want to start?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that people like the stuff. What I think still blows me away is that there's so much unheard music from the 70s that most people who consider themselves to be pretty well educated on the matter come up and like, I've never heard of any of these bands. So I think the biggest surprise for me is that there's still this many volumes of unsung heroes that have never really gotten any shine. And, but it doesn't surprise me that people are into it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. No, it's a great comp, and maybe I worded the question wrong, but there seems to be this unendless well of this sort of material, and the quality has remained tip-top. I imagine you guys are only starting to get rolling on this series. Would that be right?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. The quality is tip-top because of the amount of work that goes into licensing the material, you know? Mm. So the well, as you said, is endless, and that never ceases to amaze me. You know, still discovering records that were previously completely unknown, you know, 50, 60 years after the fact is mind-blowing, especially in the age of the internet. Mm-hmm. But the quality will always remain consistent with Brown Acid because the work that goes into licensing these tracks is difficult, time consuming, etc. So we only go after the good stuff, the top tier.
Yeah, and to pick up sort of on what Lance was saying, you know, there's some tracks that, you know, we approached in 2014, 2015 when we first got things going with this series, and we got we didn't get a response, or we got the door slammed in our face saying, you know, get out of here, kid. We don't know what you're talking about. But we've remained vigilant and kept good notes and followed up. And there's been tracks that we said, you know, the guy said, no, there's no way. And now people are coming back and saying, no, I think I'd like to be a part of this. This is cool. We're lucky that some people are starting to see the light with it. And mm-hmm. I'm always thankful every time that somebody agrees to let us include one of their songs on one of our comps.
Now, you guys are, you know, both very busy with your other gigs, have very good music taste. How do you guys divvy up the responsibilities of putting out these compilations?
Oh, that's fairly simple. I generally take care of the tracking of the bands and the initial contact. And then once the contact has been made and interest has been expressed, and I can kind of explain the gist of how things work, I pass the contacts along to Daniel, and Daniel takes care of the label end of things.
Yeah, so I'll be the one that kind of, you know, calls them or gets on email and sort of explains them how things go. Writing Easy is the one that, you know, issues the contract. We pay everybody. We do the bi-yearly accounting. When the record comes out, you know, we're the ones that make sure that all the artists, get copies of it and whatnot. We really do. You know, Writing Easy kind of does the heavy lifting on the admin side for sure.
So Lance, pretend I'm a guy whose record you just found. You want to include it on Brown Acid. You get my number. How does that pitch go?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I'm truly a fan of all this kind of stuff. So generally, I'm just ecstatic to even be on the phone with you. So the pitch is not so much a pitch as it is, you know, a fanboy exaltation, I guess, just saying, hey man, oh my gosh, I can't believe I found you. I'm so excited to have you on the phone. I really love your band. That single that you put out back in 1970 knocked my socks off when I first heard it. And I curate a series of compilations that, you know, compiles tracks of the similar ilk. Might you have some interest in re-releasing your music, you know? And then the conversation, the ball is in your court, and usually it goes well. But sometimes people aren't interested, and, you know.
Or sometimes they say, yeah, I'm totally into it. Send me the information. And then you send them the information, and then like they just drop off the face of the earth. They don't respond to emails. They don't pick up the phone. And that's where it kind of comes to like, all right, let's swing back around and check on this guy in 6 months and see what happens. And there's literally one of the tracks that's on Brown Acid, The 12th Trip, is one of those tracks. We tried to get it in 2015. I think we tried again in 2017, and it finally came through at the end of this last year. So it's really about how we've been sticking on it too, you know?
At any point, you could have dozens, maybe, you know, several dozen tracks just kind of in play.
right now we have about 90 tracks in the can that are completely signed, sealed, delivered, and licensed that we haven't used. And then there's probably another same amount where contact has been made. There's been some sort of verbal, yeah, I'm into it, send me a contract. And that's kind of where it died. And that's where we just kind of continue to follow up and we'll get there.
Yeah. Now, do you often get master tapes, or are a lot of the tracks taken off a real clean 45?
Sadly, master tapes are not in the possession of the owners of the rights or any of the guys in the bands 99% of the time.
You know, there's a lot of guys that this is honestly the first recording of theirs that they ever did. So when we come knocking and they're like, wait, you want, I did that when I was 17. That's the one you want? Dude, check out this stuff I did like last year. And you're like, no, that's not what this is about. You know, but yeah, many of the 45s that we do get for the series are most of these guys' first record that they ever cut.
So you get the audio off of a 45. I wouldn't even say a clean 45, just one of the only 45s you could find.
Whatever we can get. Yeah. Yeah. I dumped them all in over here at Writing Easy. And I've got a pretty nice needle on a Pioneer, like through a Pioneer DJ mixer into an Apogee digital converter. And then we send it to a guy who goes through, and then if there's clicks and pops, he goes through and fixes everything as good as he can. And then,
yeah, the reason I thought maybe there were some master tapes involved, because each song on the Brown Acid series, I understand it's recorded in a different studio under different circumstances, so the audio is bound to be uneven, but the comps sound really, really good sonically. So interested on how we get the balance of the sound so it doesn't have these drastic changes.
Yeah, I mean, when I dump them in, there we leave a lot of headroom and let mastering kind of do their thing. Mm-hmm. Some tracks are obviously more squashed than others. But for the most part, everything that we turn into mastering has headroom to go up or down if it needs to be. And Eric, who masters them all and cleans up all the audio files from clicks and pops and hisses and whatnot, like he takes his time with it. And, yeah. So, you know, he's got it wired, man. We're on number 12 now.
I suppose when you're talking to some of these guys, you know, I mean, these records are made when they were really, really young. I mean, they must be a distant memory to some of these people when you finally get a hold of them. Yeah.
You know, many of the guys, when we hit them up, it really is the first song they ever recorded in a studio, or it's one of the first few things that they ever did. And they're totally always shocked that that's what we're after, not something they did last year or when they were in their 20s or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It continuously blows my mind to hear these guys that we get in touch with say how old they were when they recorded some of these songs. Rod from Blizzard was 15, I think he said, when they recorded that. And I just can't even imagine a 15-year-old writing and recording and releasing a record like that nowadays.
So tell me about some of these stories, like these records that have only had, I won't even say a few hundred, some of them only a dozen were pressed up. What are some of the more incredible finds that you've had doing this detective work?
I could go on for days. Do you have one you want to talk about first, Daniel?
I mean, there's just so many. I don't know, man. I mean, I still, Crossfield, Take It to Me is probably one of those ones where you're like, how does this song not a massive hit? Like, it just feels like it should have been on the radio, and it trips me out that like it was on this tiny little label and nothing happened with it. And it's, you know, you know, but I Lance is definitely more of the music historian on these things. Like, I got too many other hobbies to be buying $500 45s and stuff. So I'm gonna let Lance maybe fill in a little bit on some of the deeper expensive cuts. Because to me, I don't get caught up in that game. I can't. There's no way I can compete.
Well, for instance, the Dickens. The story of Dickens, that sounds pretty incredible. It was a record that wasn't even meant to be recorded. It was just recorded by accident. Is that right?
Yeah. The Dickens is some of the guys from NRBQ who actually, you know, are fairly well known. But it's almost a piss take. You know, they had some some studio time, and they use that time instead of just wasting it or walking out of the studio. Or
a session that was originally scheduled for Jim Nabors, and he canceled, so the band just swiped in there and grabbed that time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's basically how I understand it as well. And not only did they swipe the time, in the interest of keeping things interesting, they just switched instruments, and each one of them played an instrument that they were not accustomed to, which, you know, when you can do that and pump something out like "Don't Talk About My Music," you know you're on to something. But the brilliance of it is you got guys who do know how to play their instruments generally, playing something they're not used to playing and still doing better than 99% of bands out there. But the rawness of that track is is just unbelievable. It's a similar story to Grand Theft, actually. I forget which trip Grand Theft is on off the top of my head.
I think it's on the fifth trip.
Yeah. So those guys were in a folk rock band called Bluebird, and Grand Theft was a not a real thing. Those guys just had extra studio time, and they recorded tracks that they thought were mocking Led Zeppelin, essentially. And, you know, their fake Led Zeppelin is almost as good as the real thing, you know?
And yeah, they did that song as well, like it's about a rat who goes and parties with Led Zeppelin at the end of after a gig. And like it's a ripping track, but the voiceover on it's really funny too. And it's definitely something we could definitely share with you, because it's a good one. It's not the fifth trip, it's on the third trip.
And with all the records that were created in that time frame and the obscurity of them, and just finding them and listening to them and critiquing them and finding the ones that you want to include in the series, that must take a tremendous amount of effort, even for someone like you, Lance, who's probably built for this more than most humans and has access to all these records. I mean, it must take a tremendous amount of time just to find the ones you want to include. Yeah.
You know, when you're a guy like me, digging for records for multiple purposes, I would say it's like finding a needle in a haystack. To find something that works for Brown Acid in the wild happens once in a blue moon, for sure. So, you know, as you know, Nate, I have a record store, so I'm always traveling, buying records, buying collections here locally, etc. And I maybe once in every 6 months, I'll find something from a dealer or something that actually works for Brown Acid. As deep as the well of hard rock, privately pressed hard rock and heavy psych is from the late 60s and early 70s, it is nothing compared to the amount of records that were released, not to mention just the records that were self-released back in the day. You know, there is a ton of crap out there in the world that just is the nature of things. But you know, as you get further along in any hobby, you get better at sussing out the wheat from the chaff. And I'm pretty good at this point at finding the good stuff. It just takes time, you know. It's not easy.
I suppose a lot of these artists would be local to a city or even a neighborhood, so you'd have to get familiar with, say, the Tallahassee market to find some of the great bands able to, you know, record.
And where there was, right? Where there was a scene for something to thrive. I mean, I think the one that comes to mind is Youngstown, Ohio. That seems to be the hotbed of where a lot of the, at least the first five trips, there is at least a band from each of the, from that place on each of those.
Why do you reckon Youngstown? What was the magic there?
It's a funny one. It's per capita, it's the Brown Acid Mecca for sure. it's unbelievable. There's a couple of things in play there. There's a couple of good studios that also doubled as labels in Youngstown. 700 West and Peppermint are both from that area. And then when you talk to people from that part of the world, it's that part of the United States is just, it's a working class spot. But it's on the East Coast where you're not far from a lot of really interesting stuff happening. So if you want to be in a band, but you don't need it to be what you do for a living, living in a small town or a relatively small town, that's a college town there in Ohio, with, you know, close proximity to big cities, to be able to play with, you know, be the opening act for touring artists, or, you know, just be aware of what's happening in bigger cities and be able to shoot for those stars. I think that's the perfect nest, if you will, you know, breeding ground.
Yeah. I guess there would have to be like a manufacturing angle there, because if there's disposable income, then people would be able to afford to get their music pressed up.
Exactly. It's all the stars were aligned in Youngstown. It's just that kind of, it's that work for the hard rock sound too. Like, again, it's like a muscle car city. It's a working class place, and it's what the people wanted. It's what the people were into. And it just, you know, and it wasn't too far from New York or Philly or Cleveland or, you know, Detroit, et cetera.
There was a scene. There was, you know, there were studios to get things recorded. There was clubs to play. And it wasn't just the rock stuff. Like, wasn't Iron Knowledge from there as well, Lance?
Right around there. They're from Ohio for sure.
Yeah. So like Iron Knowledge was like a fuzzed out funk band. But, you know, in the realm of funkadelic, they were black, you know what I mean? Like, and they're on trip number two. And when you hear it, there's a sick drum break in it and the whole deal. And like, but it still had tonal qualities, you know, even though it was kind of a funk rock track, it still had it was fuzzed out. And there was something definitely going on for sure.
So when you're dealing with a lot of these bands, you know, getting these one-off, these singles for the Brown Acid series, do you ever find that they have more recordings, even like almost an album put together?
Yeah, absolutely. That's happened a few times. At first we kind of were like, you know, Lance will be like, hey, you know, there's actually this whole album of stuff that they never got put out. We should maybe listen to it. We've had a few things where we just ended up grabbing the one song because the rest of the record wasn't maybe in the same style, but a few records that we have put out that that came out of the Brown Acid started off with one song, and then there was a full record, was a band from Texas called Spiny Norman, which the album was recorded in like 81 or 79 to 81. But if you listen to it, it literally sounds like Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It sounds like it was recorded 12 years before it was done. And then stylistically, musically, it's like, it's so fucking weird. That's what those guys were doing at that point in time in history.
When it's like if Hawkwind were from Texas almost. Oh.
So that's
where you guys found Spiny Norman from trying to find a track for Brown Acid. You guys were able to get the whole album.
Yeah, actually Spiny Norman came from Shroom Angel Records, and we had licensed a couple of songs from Rich Patz, who owns the label, and he's like, hey, you guys might be into this band. This band's never been released before. I ended up getting the masters a while back, and I haven't been able to put it out. Yeah, that's kind of how it started. And then it was like, dude, this is really fucking cool, man. So we ended up putting that one out, and like, it wasn't a huge release or success, but there's definitely enough people that were excited that we unearthed it and put it out, and you can get a clean copy of it.
Just to clarify, that stuff was all previously unreleased, and we put Bell Park Loon on the second trip.
Correct.
Obviously subsequently released the entire LP.
From that. Yeah.
Is that how you found Randy Holden as well?
Randy just came from out of the blue. We had been trying to get a hold of Randy. Then my buddy in North Carolina, who runs records out there, he had just had him like on his podcast. And then he's like, dude, this, I'm going to put you in touch with Randy. I think he might be ready to talk to somebody. I don't know. Like, he had shunned all the time. Anyways, yes, Randy Holden ended up, like, after many, many hours of coercing and showing him that he's in a safe place, he allowed for us to do that. And now Randy's like my long lost uncle, texting me pictures of his puppy all the time and showing me new guitars and talking about Mustangs and all kinds of wacky stuff. So it's all, yeah, it's like a big family affair now.
The fact that Daniel was able to talk Randy into reissuing Population 2 is a testament to the kind of person Daniel is. He's honest. He's straightforward. He's a no nonsense kind of guy who just tells people like it is, and gets them to, even though they're apprehensive, or when they are apprehensive and don't want to work with anyone else, Daniel's got the charisma to actually get them to see the light. And that's something that I really appreciate about how Daniel works. He's able to accomplish the impossible sometimes. And I appreciate that because I talk to a lot of guys, you know, from vetting different artists for Brown Acid, some people just don't want to do it. They're skeptical. They think it's some sort of scam. You know, they think they're going to have to pay to be involved in the compilation series. A lot of these guys got ripped off big time back in the day, so they don't want to hear a bunch of big talk from music execs, if you will, you know. And Daniel is, like I said, he's a down-to-earth, easy-to-talk-to guy that can explain things to people in a way that make them understand and see the light in getting their music reissued. And Population 2 was in desperate need of being reissued, and Daniel was able to make that happen, and Randy is happier than a pig and you know what.
Yeah, dude, I mean, it's the first time that anybody's given Randy any checks for music or anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's been shocked, and like the fact that, like, you know, I mean, it just, you know, it's again, it's like a lot of these, that everybody that we work with for the most part has some sort of a trust issue working with the record label. Mm-hmm. And so it's been good to be able to show them a positive experience on that end. It's something that, you know, that's almost just as rewarding as getting the comps out, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's because you could tell it's good vibes.
Well, yeah, it's a positive tick for humanity, you know? It's, and the fact that they're getting a check and, you know, finally getting something for the work that they've done, and it confirms that there are good people out there. So
sure. And just the recognition as well. There's actually a band on Brown Acid, the 12th trip, called White Lightning, that we have a full album worth of stuff to put out. And that's going to come out this summer, probably in August. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey, folks, let me tell you about AudiophileUSA.com, the online record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. And hey, they've got like 45,000 records in stock, all in gorgeous shape and ready to ship to you around the world. Whether you're in Seoul, Seattle, Sydney, or Singapore, AudiophileUSA.com will get you the most beautiful records you'll ever see. Dig through their listings at AudiophileUSA.com, find those deals, go deep into genres and record labels, and you will find some gold. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. We are brought to you in part today by the Groove Washer Record Cleaner. The best record cleaner on earth. I use the Groove Washer multiple times each day. I even just got gifted one of those vacuum record cleaning machines, one of those really nice, expensive ones, yet I still use the Groove Washer. That Groove Washer G2 fluid they make is perfect for record maniacs or hobbyists. Whatever level you're at in terms of your record collection, ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store, or go to groovewasher.com, use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 for a discount, and get the world's best record cleaner shipped directly to you. That's groovewasher.com, promo code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program already in progress.
Now, it sounds like the majority of the artists on the whole series, you know, 1 through 12 so far, are from the U.S. I saw you had a couple of international ones, even Ash from Australia. How many other bands do you have, or how do you find the bands that are beyond the borders of the U.S.?
I'd say the process is still the same. Unfortunately, the artists from... Well, the records, the artists are there. As you know, Nate, you know Buffalo and the wealth of hard rock from Australia is
huge.
Yeah, it's massive. The issue for us as people who are licensing music for a compilation series on a budget is that you can't touch a major label record with a 10-foot pole, you know? So the private press... world is a fairly uniquely American thing. So once you go outside of the borders of the U.S., you get diminishing returns with self-released music. And so the things we've been able to, the international stuff we've been able to license has been few and far between because of that. There's a lot of stuff on my radar and a lot of records in my collection from Europe and from Australia, et cetera. But a lot of them were released on subsidiaries or major labels themselves. And, sure.
Yeah, or they weren't. And at some point they were acquired in some sort of deal with something else. And that leads us to that. And one of the things we actually can take pride on is that we don't put something out unless we have an agreement with the artist and everybody gets paid. Like it's something that we actually, wanted to make sure we drove that point home, because there's a lot of these kinds of comps out there that don't pay anybody.
Right.
Yeah. Every, you know, if you're familiar with punk rock and you know Killed by Death and the Bloodstained series, those are all bootleg comps. They're great comps, but none of those bands got paid. If you and don't even get me started on 60s garage stuff and how many Nuggets ripoffs there. I know, Nate, you just recently interviewed Lenny Kaye. There's so many Nuggets ripoffs comps where people are essentially just releasing mixtapes on vinyl and CD, and none of those artists are actually getting anything most of the time. And that's one of the things when Daniel and I first got started. It was a thing that we both felt strongly about and knew that it was only going to work if we licensed the material. And that's why we've been able to have the longevity that we have, because we don't have to hide behind a curtain. We can be out and out about Brown Acid and be loud and proud about it.
That's right.
That's great. Yeah. This is probably the first time any of these guys have been paid for their music literally in decades. So
a lot of them, it's the first time in their life
ever. Yeah.
Ever. Like, they can't, and then when they get like a, you know, when they've gotten a few statements in, they're like blown away and they're like, dude, I know it's not that much, but you guys send it every time. It's great. It's like unbelievable. Like, you guys actually do what you said you're going to do. You know what I mean? Like, so that's important.
That's a hard thing to find in the music business.
Yeah, and especially if you come from that era of the music business where it really was, it was not artist friendly at all. People got fucked. They got taken advantage of, and you know, so we're trying to do them right that way. And I think that that kind of good energy, you put that out and it comes back to you tenfold if you do it right. So
now when you reach out to an artist, you probably, you know, let's say there's four or five guys in a band, you talk to one of them, you manage to get a hold of one of them. Do you have to have all five on board, or is...
No, I kind of feel like, I mean, having, you know, running Writing Easy Records, I also have, I mean, we're not a reissue label. The focus over here is new bands. And the reissue, the Brown Acid stuff makes sense because it's, you know, predates the kind of music or the kind of bands that I work with, but it's still in the same vein. There's always one leader in the band. You deal with one person. It's usually the person who wrote the song or sang the song or whatever, but it's usually one person in the band can kind of say, we talk to people and, you know, feel them out. But if their name is on the credits of the record, and they give us word that it's cool and they sign our our simple contract and we pay them, in my mind, that permission is had.
Done deal. Right.
Yeah. And
just to side note, Nate, I'm lucky to find one surviving member of most of these bands. You know, time is of the essence for us. And we've experienced at least a couple of different times now where the situation where the one surviving member of the band that we've licensed a track by has passed, you know. Mm-hmm. So it that's hard enough. But I will say, just from my perspective, most of the time when I do get in touch with someone from the band, they say, I want to run this by my former bandmates first. And they do get like kind of informal agreement, consensus, you know. So there's usually, even if we only have one contact point, there's usually consensus among all the band members, or they won't sign too. That's part of the problem sometimes.
Which has been part of that's absolutely happened for sure. Yeah.
Where you
like the point of contact in the band that we have, he's cool with it, but wants to check with, you know, whoever sang on it or whatever. And they might be like, I don't like that recording. I don't think it should be out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
We're waiting to track them down. So we'll track a band member and they'll say, okay, as soon as I can get a hold of these other guys who I haven't talked to forever, then I'll get in touch with you. We'll hear from them 3 years later. Sometimes that story is, you're not going to believe this, I tracked down all the former band members and we're jamming again. And that's a really great feeling to know that you were the impetus for a little reunion.
You could have a Brown Acid Fest in Youngstown, Ohio at some point.
Yeah. There won't be anybody younger than 70 on the stage.
So when you're talking to these band members, I would imagine some of them still have some of the records or even a box of records in the garage that they couldn't move for, you know, 40 years. Do you find that's the case as well?
It's rare, but it does happen. Yeah, it's more often than not, there are no or one copy in the possession of the band members. Mm-hmm. But occasionally, very, very occasionally, there will be some stock copies to procure. And if the band members are willing to sell them, I buy them, you know.
Yeah, we were able to get copies of Glass Sun, Silence of the Morning, 7 inches for definitely lower than eBay prices, but they were still pricey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, everybody has access to all the same information these days. So, you know, finding a box of a rare single and getting it for next to nothing is just, it's not the same thing it used to be pre-internet.
Yeah. Sure. Now, after the Brown Acid comps come out, do you find the collectability of those original records goes higher, lower, or where's it?
Higher, absolutely. Yeah, we just put it on a bunch of people's radar. And then somebody's like, oh my God, that song rips so hard. And then it goes in their Discogs want list and then pops up and it goes from maybe like 3 people want this record to like 50 people want this record, which doesn't sound like that much. But if you have 50 people willing to pay a few hundred bucks for a 7-inch, guess what? That 7-inch sells for a few hundred bucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have many bands that have been repeated across the series?
Yeah. I mean, like, absolutely. We've got a handful of bands that we grabbed more than one song from, or maybe both sides of the 7-inch. You know, one of them's from the UK. It's a band called Factory. That 7-inch, I think there was only 98 pressed or something.
Yeah, 99.
Yeah, it was really low. I don't have a copy of it, but we do have the digital on both of it. So yeah, so the second song will be the first one. The first Factory came out on what? Brown Acid, like 4 or 5? I can't remember. A while ago. We try not to repeat bands too.
It's hard to keep track.
Yeah.
It really is hard now. Yeah. I mean, we're literally dealing with several hundred songs now.
And it sounds like you've got plenty to make it to the 20th.
Oh, we're going to go 20. No problem. I mean, dude, we could stop what we're doing right now, never pursue another one, and we would make it past 20. Mm-hmm. Actually.
Do you have scouts, like, and probably more to Lance, you know, with your network of record collectors, do you have scouts that are always sending you the, you know, records from different parts of the world, record collector friends who are like, hey, this may be good for Brown Acid. You have people looking out for you that way?
Absolutely. Yeah. I wouldn't have referred to them as scouts before you said that. Just homies that are, you know, like-minded, that are into similar stuff. But yeah, people sometimes, in order to unload a record, they'll hit me up, you know, because they know I'll pay top dollar for something I don't already have. But, you know, there's a lot of collectors in this world that are just genuinely nice people looking to share knowledge. And yeah, I have a good friend in Sweden named Jan Raymond that I reference in the liner notes of one of the early volumes. He was just a fan of the series and said, "Hey, I like this same stuff, and I want to share these singles that I picked up recently. Check these out," you know. And yeah, there's friends down in Australia, actually, and a lot of people here domestically that know that I'm always on the hunt for this kind of stuff. It kind of takes a village. We do all the heavy lifting, but getting hot tips is never a bad thing.
No, yeah, and just, you know, it's like if you build it, they will come. And you know, we've definitely had people like just say, "Hey, this is my uncle's band from like 69. You should check this out." Sometimes it's cool, you know what I mean? Yeah. So the dead people definitely, when they see, it's like, you know, we've called it something and said, "This is the, you know, this is the brand name for this." And now there's, you know, people can say, "Oh, this sounds like a Brown Acid song." Like it's like the set of guidelines to go by, you know, is it lo-fi? Is it fuzzed out? Is it rock and roll? You know what I mean? Like that's kind of, mm-hmm.
I noticed on one of the artists, you actually got a video, Ash Midnight Witch. Do you get many videos? I mean, I would only say probably a handful. Yeah.
Yeah. That was on Australian TV. We just grabbed it off the internet and ran with it. I mean, we didn't try to act like we shot the video. It was shot before we were even born.
Of course. Yeah.
There's not that most of the bands that we work with, the only media that exists on them literally is maybe some photos and some flyers in their attic and whatever 7-inch this is. Most of these bands were never worth rolling out the red carpet and the cameras and all that shit for.
Well, man, I got to tell you, every time a release of Brown Acid comes out, I'm always impressed. There's always such great underground music. It sounds fantastic. And I'm so glad that you guys are doing the difficult job of curating these collections, because I think they really do deserve to see the light of day and to have people enjoy them rather than, you know, be relinquished to obscurity. So well done to you guys for putting in the hard yards and getting this stuff out there.
Yeah, thanks, man.
The kickoff, the pre-sale of Brown Acid, the 12th trip, is on February 17th. That's 2 days from now. Well, depending on when you're listening to this, we're going to release it on the 15th. You got 2 days to get your calendar in order to make sure you're ready for the pre-sale at RidingEasyRex.com. Daniel, what kind of special pressings are you guys going to have on the pre-sale the first day?
We'll always do like a splat where there's going to be a splattered color, like a limited to 100 that we offer exclusively through our site. And then, obviously there's going to be an exclusive permanent color as well. Lance hasn't told me what that is, but Lance, you can announce that right now. What color record is yours going to be?
Let's keep it secret. You'll have to come to permanentrecordsla.com on pre-order day to find out.
That's right.
Okay, good. We'll have a link in this episode page towards that. Lance, let's talk about Permanent. I always looked forward to going to Permanent every time I went into LA. That was one of the two or three shops that I would absolutely make my way to on the first day. This last year, obviously, has been difficult for most businesses, but I've noticed that Permanent continues to hustle quite well on Instagram. How's the year been for you?
The year, surprisingly, from a numbers perspective, has been pretty good to Permanent. A lot has changed. Our entire operation is under the roof of the newly minted Permanent Records Roadhouse, which we opened in October of 2019, just 5 months before we were forced into closure due to the pandemic. And at the Roadhouse, we're a bar, a live music venue, and a record store all under one roof. So that is closed temporarily. But that said, we pivoted into selling records online through our Instagram page of all places at the beginning of the pandemic. And that has been really good for us. People are stuck at home, you know, sitting in front of their turntables and enjoying their record collections and buying new and used records from us in a way that I never thought I would sell records online. You know, I started Permanent 15 years ago in Chicago as a brick and mortar store in 1,000 square foot storefront. And that's the way I like doing business, in person with real time, real people interactions. But that's not possible or particularly safe right now. So we switched it up and it's been great. So until the pandemic is over and it's safe, and we're allowed to open the bar again, we're just going to continue to offer records new and used up for sale on our Instagram page at least 5 nights a week. We do a, you know, 3-4 hour run of hundreds of records each night, and we sell through most of them. Yeah, it's a ton of work, but it's been fun. People are making a game out of it because you have to be the first to call dibs on any given record that's offered up for sale to to get the right to purchase it. And it's been wild, but we're doing okay.
It's really fun. I've been participating quite a bit, actually, maybe a little too much for my pocketbook. But yeah, these, it's like instant auctions. Not only do you have to say dibs, but you want to be creative about it too.
Spicy dibs.
Spice those dibs up. Yes.
Spice your dibs up, dude.
Unfortunately, because Instagram was not created for our purposes, we have to work around some of their, you know, nuances. And one of those things is making sure your comments are varied so that they don't get automatically deleted by the bots. The Instagram bots have been very cruel to us occasionally, not allowing us to post all the records we want to, et cetera. I won't go into the boring details of it, but for the most part, it's working out. Everybody's happy and everybody gets the stuff they want.
That's great. Look, and Lance, I've always admired your hustle, and I know it's just, it's not just what you do, but it's who you are. I'd go into record fairs. I think I'm getting there early at like 7 a.m. That's when you're leaving the record fair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the day's over at 7. I'm back to the shop by then.
So are you seeing a path to keep it all going after COVID?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's, and thank you for the kind words, Nate. It's nice to, you know, it's one thing to hustle, but to see or to hear someone else see it and appreciate it is another thing altogether. So thank you for that. And yes, because of our hustle, you know, I'm not alone in this. I have Tara and Miguel and Bridget and Maggie backing me up. We will get through the pandemic and we will reopen the Roadhouse and we'll be better than ever. So there is a path. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's just a matter of biding our time until we get there.
Now, question for both of you. What do you think the vinyl market will be like once everything gets back to whatever that next state of normal is? Will it be drastically different than it was before?
I don't think it's slowing down, dude. I can speak from experience of on the pressing side. I've been involved with pressing records now for 25 years. It used to be that, I mean, when I first started writing Easy Records, not even that long ago, 2013, if you had your art and your audio all turned in at once, it was 4 to 5 weeks until you had your whole order of records in the back of your truck. Now you're lucky if it's 4 months. I mean, the lead times have just grown crazy. So, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any time soon that the vinyl industry is going to be slowing down on new things. I think it's become almost as synonymous as people buying t-shirts of a band that they like. I can't speak as much for the used because my hustle, but Lance is the gangster of all of them for that.
Yeah, I don't see that slowing down anytime in the near future either. It's great. And any, you know, I think all of us can agree that when you get the bug, you know, to whatever degree you get the collecting bug, it sticks with you. It's hard to shake. And as long as people, new participants, are getting involved, the amount of people coming to the game is always going to be higher than the amount of people leaving the game. And as, you know, younger people getting into it age, they tend to earn more money and have more disposable income to buy better and more collectible records. And yeah, I mean, as long as, you know, barring some completely unforeseen situation, the digital world already is where it is, that we're over that hump. People are into buying records. And, you know, I've been into buying records for a long time, and I can't imagine a scenario where I decide not to to collect anymore. It just gets more and more expensive for me all the time.
You're never going to trade in your collection, Lance, for CDs? You're not going to do that?
I don't think there's any going back for me, but I am kind of blown away by the fact that we still are able to sell CDs. Not for a lot of money, but people still buy them unbelievably. So,
dude, we sell a shitload of CDs. Every single one of our releases sells at least 1,000 CDs.
It's unbelievable. I don't personally know anyone that collects CDs, but those people are out there.
Yeah, I know over the last year, it seems like used records have continued to rise, and actually quite substantially. And at least from my perspective, a couple things play into that. Number one, without being able to go to restaurants or cafes or anything, it got more disposable income. And number two, there's also this feeling of mortality now. I'm more for living in the moment now. So if I want to spend $100 on that Melvins record, God damn it, I'm going to do it now. Where in the past, sure, I would have hesitated.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, again, just because that's, time is precious, and, you know, I only have so much time on this earth. And if that's what I want and I'm able to do it, then I'm going to do it.
You're going to do it. You're not holding out hoping it pops up for a lower price.
Or, you know, oh, maybe I should hold on to that because I've got this light bill coming up or something like that. I'm starting to kind of throw a little bit more caution to the wind.
Right.
There,
that's a personal thing. I don't, maybe others are thinking the same, but yeah, I've gotten a little less discriminate about the amount I spend on records this year.
I think the permanent record slogan says it all, Nate. Life is short. Buy more records.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's a tattoo right there. All right, gentlemen. So Brown Acid, the 12th trip. Again, guys, thank you so much for sharing us and taking us on our own little Brown Acid trip here. Again, Brown Acid, the 12th trip, available pre-sale February 17th. Head over to writingeasyrex.com to be able to pick up a copy. There's also a special version over at permanentrecordsla.com, and follow them on Instagram at permanentrecordsla as well. Guys, thanks again for coming on the Vinyl Guide, and we really appreciate you taking us down that path.
All right, thanks a lot. Yeah, street date is also 420. For those who just want to wait to get it in their record store.
Why that date?
My two favorite holidays is 420 and Halloween, so that's what we made Brown Acid release dates on. Ensuring that there's going to be fresh tunes for those glorious days all the time.
So Lance, why don't you introduce us, tee us up for the song that we're about to play?
Sure. Yeah, The Waters, Mother Samwell is a 45 that came out in 1969. The band is from Louisville, Kentucky, of all places. And this track is an absolute head crusher of a heavy psych jam.
Me.
is a killer. And let me tell you, the rest of the album burns just as hot. That is one of the tracks on the upcoming Brown Acid compilation, Trip Number 12. Vinyl pre-orders available Wednesday, February 17th at RidingEasyRex.com. Set your alarm, write it in your calendar, whatever you got to do, because on that day, there's going to be some extremely limited pressings available to order at RidingEasyRex.com. So be there. And by the way, if you enjoyed this interview, there's more on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us up there, help support this show, and hear the rest of the interview. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, please share these episodes on your social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever you got to do. Help us spread the word. And of course, we always appreciate it when people leave us positive reviews. Log into iTunes or Stitcher, whatever platform you're on. Give us 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10. Say something nice, make us blush, do whatever you got to do. But please help us spread the word of the Vinyl Guide podcast to you and all your record nerd buddies. That is hugely appreciated. And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
Sir Law and the Master of the Hutter, so again, under every elf, he has the elf, his desire to heal her. And the mouse must do this, but there's not here, because you can't tell it. There's not half, but isn't it? He was, nay, but I'm the hit. There I ride a few. Oh, sound as well, no. Sound as he read this. Oh, heck, look.
Yeah, I'm nice, dude. This nice, dude. Yeah, I promise that I can't tell him. I got what I'm watching now for the rest of the week.
Yeah, will not hurt if they're all murders us. You're the one I've lost. That we says, guess the sign our bug views.